Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Ed Catmull, the president of Pixar and Disney Animation. He's here to talk to us today about why he joined the Middle Way Society, his new book, Creativity Inc., and what his understanding is of the Middle Way. Hello, Ed. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Can you start off by telling us a bit about your background?
Well, I grew up in Utah, and it was actually a wonderful time during the 50s. And it was a time when I wanted to be an animator. I was very influenced by Walt Disney.
Okay.
And I also was in love with physics. So my two heroes were Einstein and Walt Disney. And when I got to near the end of high school, I realized that I couldn't draw at the level that the Disney animators did, so I switched over into physics.
Yeah.
Now, when I tell people that, usually there's a giggle in the audience. And that's because these things are conceived of as like two completely separate things. Like, why would you go from art to physics?
Yeah.
They don't belong together. And in my mind, though, actually they did belong together, and they still do. So, and I wouldn't say I put it in these terms then, but I now look back and say, well, okay, here are these two things considered to be different, which was art and animation, and the other being physics and science and math. And there was something about being in the middle of both of them, which for me was energizing and exciting. So I went into physics, got my undergraduate degree in physics, but because I took a lot of classes, I also studied computer science and realized that this time that computer graphics was a place where the potentially the art and the science came together. So I had the view then I'm going to mix them together and try to make a computer animated film.
Right. So that was an ambition at a very early age then.
Yes. Well, it was in graduate school, actually, where I put these things together. But I was in an environment where they were very supportive of unusual ideas. It was a very protective environment. Uh-huh. And I recognized it at the time that by having an environment where people were protected in coming up with new things, that you actually had people become more creative.
Okay. It's interesting. I was talking to someone the other day about a similar theme, that 50 years ago, if you were going to do science, it was just a matter of course that you would do something within the humanities too, that you'd get that balance. Was that similar in the States 50, 60 years ago? If you did science, you would also do philosophy maybe or the arts or something like that, or were they always kept separate?
Well, I was at the University of Utah, and I would say that the philosophy at that time, and I think it is still at a lot of universities, is that you are better off having a balanced education.
Yeah.
So the requirements included philosophy and economics and English, and I took all of those courses, and I took a language course. And I viewed them at the time as part of a balance. So it wasn't as if I was forced into doing anything. I really liked taking all these different classes.
Okay.
And I still feel it's the right thing. Is there's that balance of the humanities and the arts and the sciences, which is better. And the way I try to conceive of it, because people sometimes think they have to pick between going broad or going deep. And the notion is that, well, okay, you need to go deep, and so some of the stuff goes to the wayside. Uh-huh. And I think it's the wrong conclusion. And that is, you actually do want to go broad, but you want to have the experience of going deep. You really do want both.
Both, yeah.
And if you've experienced going deep, then in going broad, you may actually change where you want to go because you've got the breath.
Yeah.
But you know something about yourself and about the world if you can go really deep into a subject.
Okay. And so with that grounding, maybe let's move on to the main topic of our talk today then, Ed, that namely that how one sets up the conditions in a work environment so that creativity can occur. Now, you have done this very successfully as a president of Pixar and Disney Animation, and you've distilled 30 years of experience into this book entitled Creativity Inc., which has just recently come out. Can you give us an overview of the book?
Yes. The first part of it is a sort of historical setup for the problem of what it means to support a creative environment and the lessons that we learned along the way and the mistakes. And there were some phenomenal people along this journey. So there was Steve Jobs and George Lucas and John Lasseter and rather amazing people to work with.
Yeah.
But then reaching a point where the goal that I'd had for 20 years had been achieved, which was we made the first computer animated film. And so in my life and in the book, I say, well, okay, at this point, there's now a problem. It's in achieving a goal, you've actually eliminated the goal. So the question is, what is the new thing? And it wasn't as if you can say, oh, well, let's make another film. And I realized the goal was actually not a particular goal because I didn't actually know what the film would be. It was a framework in which one made decisions.
Okay.
And it's the way I tend to think about goals. So then I had to look back and say, okay, what's the new framework? And for me, the framework was, how do you have a creative or a sustained creative environment? Because what I observed in this previous period of time was that lots of creative groups come together and do rather amazing things, and then they fall apart.
Yep.
So our question isn't, can we do something creative? Because the answer is a lot of people do. It's what happens to us when we succeed that screws our minds up and has us go down the wrong path. And can we be aware of those problems and address them? So the next part of the book is, okay, what are the barriers that get in the way of a group retaining its creativity?
Okay.
And there are a few clear things that get in the way. One of them has to do with making mistakes and our fear of failure. So that's a pretty big area. And regardless of what we say, and people talk about failure a lot,
right? Yeah.
They will say failure is necessary to grow, and you must go through failure, and you must look at it in a good way. So regardless of the fact that we accept that intellectually, that failure is part of our growth and was through our entire life, we don't believe it.
No.
Because we have ingrained in us two different meanings of failure. One of them is the one that we learned in school, which was if you fail in school, it meant you were either dumb or you didn't work hard or you screwed up. And so the failure in a class was a mark of shame, basically.
Yeah.
But it's even compounded by if you look at the world today with politicians or with businesses. To admit a mistake is to subject yourself to ridicule by others.
Definitely.
Right. So there's a real danger that comes along with errors and mistakes. It's palpable, and we see it every day. So even though we've got an intellectual understanding of failure and mistakes, which is that, oh, well, it's good and it's part of learning, there's the other thing inside of us which says, oh, no, it is dangerous. Not only from my past I've learned it's dangerous, but from the present newspapers I learned that it's dangerous.
Yeah.
So we'll say one thing, but we try to avoid it. And so one of the issues is how we think about a view holding contradictory notions of failure inside of us. That is, what is the middle way between our intellectual understanding of failure and mistakes as part of growth and failure and mistakes as part of screwing up or danger.
Yeah.
So that's one area. The other one has to do with a misunderstanding of what it means to do something that's new, that is creative. So there is a common misconception that creativity is about expression, and people don't know quite what lets some people be better at expressing themselves, whether it's by words or music or by visuals.
Yeah.
But this is too narrow of a view of creativity. I think the broader view is that we are solving the problems of life, that we add that to it, that when we address those problems, then we are creative. And it doesn't matter where you are. So what are the things that get in the way? And they usually are external forces. Like if your boss or somebody around there wants to control the environment, you want to please the boss. You don't want to embarrass yourself. There are also all kinds of subtle psychological things which cause us to shut down. So we think we're working on the problem, but in fact, we are reacting in an environment of not wanting to displease others. And the analogy we have for filmmaking is that when we start making a film, the original film that we make actually isn't very good. And when I tell people this, they sometimes think that we're being self-effacing or modest, but I don't mean it in that sense. What I do mean it in the sense that the films actually suck. I mean, they really aren't good when we start.
Yeah.
And since they aren't good, then how do you judge the progress? Because you've already said it isn't good. And you can't skewer the team for doing something that isn't good because we just said that's the way they all start off. So how do you then protect something at its early stages when it is ill-formed and when it is ugly? Now, on the other side of that, you can't protect something forever. So if you're trying to solve a problem, then at some point what you're doing has to engage with the outside world or with the rest of your company, and in our case.
Of course, yeah.
So there is this point, a middle point,
yeah,
between when something doesn't work and you're protecting it and when you have to fully engage. And that middle point is very ill-defined. It's not crisp. So I actually originally had another chapter which removed because it was too hard to explain, but it had to do with the middle.
Yeah.
Because middle likewise has dual meanings. There is a sort of that, like the middle between the extremes and a balance and sort of a calm in the middle. But also a lot of people are grow up with the notion of middle is average.
Yeah.
It's lukewarm.
Yeah. An unsatisfactory compromise in some kind of way.
Yeah. So that meaning gets conflated with the reality of our lives. The lives is we are in the middle of extremes.
Yeah.
And the tendency is for people to want to go to the clarity of the extreme. And what they want to do is they want to skip around the mess in the middle.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a hard concept to get around. So if you think about books of advice or business or books where they teach you things, there is value because you are trying to learn the experience of others to help you as you deal with whatever your problems are. So that's the positive aspect of reading. But there's another side to it, which is sometimes you want to read how to do something or learn from others because you want to skip the mess in the middle. And so trying to describe the difference between learning in order to address the problems in the middle versus learning to avoid the problems in the middle is very subtle, but it's very important.
Yeah.
And most people want to avoid this mess in the middle. And this is where life is. It's complicated. It's messy. And avoiding it actually puts us in a different path. It puts us in the wrong place. And it is the uncreative way to go. The creative direction to go is right into the problem.
Okay, and that I think that's a pretty good summary of the book. You actually said in the endorsement that you gave for Robert Ellis's latest book, Middleism, the middle is the chaotic and confusing place between the extremes. While extremes are simpler and more attractive, it is the mess in the middle where the interesting and creative activities occur. It is where we should be. And so that's what you basically said there in essence, wasn't it, Ed?
Yes.
Okay, just delving in a little bit more into the book. You said in your book that making pictures with a computer spoke to both sides of your brain. Now, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but could you expand a little bit on that a bit more?
Yes. Well, when I say both sides, of course, neurologically now that the notion of the two sides of the brain doesn't hold up anymore. But there are many different components in the way that we think in the way we look at the world. And as I've gone through this, I've learned things about myself which I didn't realize just trying to think about it. There is a part of me where I like the storytelling and the imagery and the understanding. And storytelling is a way of conveying what you believe to somebody else. In fact, it's the way we communicate as humans with each other. So it isn't about entertainment. It actually touches everything, whether it's news or reading to our children or telling people what happened or explaining things to people. And that concept of presenting something is very enticing, but it's also based upon trying to understand things. Well, what are we trying to understand? And I found trying to understand the way the world works, there's via physics and science and chemistry, really exciting and really intriguing. So that pulled me in, just to understand it and to think about the math and the problems that are generated. So I love that. So that pulled on me to understand it. But in the process of working on computer animation, I discovered a third kind of problem to understand. So aside from how do you tell the stories or how does physics work, it's how do people work? And it wasn't sort of the obvious thing, like how do people work? It was observing that people would know something and talk about it, an example being the importance of failure, and then they would do the opposite of what they would say. Well, that's a really interesting problem. Or groups would come together and create companies and do something which was actually, or that did change the world in terms of the technology or the software or the tools that were made available, and then that group would fall apart. Well, that's a really interesting question. How did that group fall apart? What happened there? And the conclusion I came to, conclusion is a little strong word, but the observation is that we see and understand far less than we think we do. That there is so much that is hidden from us at multiple levels. And it's one of the things I tried to describe in the book. I don't know how successful I was because it's a little too complicated for most people. But the concept that the vast majority of the world, even locally, I'm not talking about the whole universe, but the vast majority of the world is obscure and hidden from us. And we are unaware of this. If we were aware of it, it wouldn't be hidden from us.
Exactly, yeah. One insight from the book that I personally found extremely useful, Ed, and which I've started to use in my own life, is the distinction you made between honesty and candor. It also seems central to the philosophy you've developed. Could you elaborate on that and why you feel it's so important?
Yes. Well, in looking at groups, I did discover that since most of the things were fairly obvious and yet they missed them, then I had to figure out, okay, why is it that people are missing them? So an example would be honesty. So let's take the principle that you should be honest with each other. And I'll use work as an example. Like you tell people what you think or what the problem is, and in being honest with them, you are giving them information which will help them in what they're doing.
Okay.
Everybody agrees with that. And because it's so obviously true, they're able to nod their head in agreement, and then that truth has no bearing on their behavior whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that is true with most truths. That if you look back at the wisdom of the ages, so going back to the Axial Age, and you look at what was written in China and India and in Greece and what the philosophers in those three different cultures were saying, they were coming up with a lot of these truths, and you come up with these encapsulations. We pass them on and we know them, but we know that most people knowing these things are unaffected by the truths. So the question is, how do you reword things so that you drop away from the obviousness of it and take away some of the baggage? So with honesty, for instance, the opposite of honesty is dishonesty.
Yeah.
And that's so obviously bad that you wouldn't go there. But if you switch over to candor, then you can have a different thing, because we don't have a word called discandor. So then we can have a discussion. Are there times when you wouldn't be candid? And the answer is, yeah, I don't want to embarrass somebody. I don't want to embarrass myself.
Yeah.
Or you find people are sort of grandstanding. There are all sorts of little barriers that get in the way. Now, they're a little less loaded, because we can talk about the fact that we don't want to embarrass somebody, or we don't want to look bad, and therefore we're going to hold back. Well, that's a problem. Well, now if we can discuss the problem, then we're now engaging in the discussion, rather than using a word like honesty, which gets in the way of the discussion, even though at heart we are talking about being honest with each other.
No, I think that's a really good approach to a very delicate subject there. Why is it that, this is something else from the book, why is it vital that the structure of communication in an organization should not follow the structure of the organization?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that, because very few people pick up on the subtlety of this. If you look at most organizations, and I would say that filmmaking is the same, in that in order to get something done with hundreds of people on a budget and on a schedule, you must be highly organized. So there is a structure in place, and there is someone who will make the final call on what belongs together, who is the director of the film. Okay, so there's a hierarchical structure there in order to get things done. Now, because this is where the power of the organization is, then a lot of people make their judgments based upon how it's going to fit within that power and where they are relative to the other people in that structure.
Okay.
Okay, so it's a natural thing, and it's a human reaction to fit within that. All right, but let's look at the nature of problems themselves. In our case, we're trying to make a film, but it could be any problem. Where there are literally tens of thousands of decisions and complications, and you don't know ahead of time which are important and which are not important. So if you just look at, you know, your day, you've got lots of little tiny things that go wrong. We don't even usually call them problems, but there are a zillion of little things there, like, you know, you run out of toothpaste, or you get there and you find that you don't have gas in your car.
Yeah.
They're little things like that. They're annoyances. There's a smaller number of bigger problems, and even smaller number of really big problems. And some of the important things to understand is the nature of the problems is that they are unbounded. So somebody could die or get hit by a car. We could have global warming. There are unbounded nature of these problems. The structure of those problems is different than our organizational structure. So if I'm trying to make a movie, the very nature of the film we're trying to solve is not the same thing as our organizational structure. So we have to actually think about a separation between the two. And if I've got something complicated, then what I want to do is have everybody engaged in trying to solve the problems. So if they're thinking hierarchically, then they're not thinking creatively. And what we do is we narrow the decision making down to a small number of people at the top. But if we actually break this apart and say, okay, I'm going to give you responsibility to make decisions and make mistakes without checking in and empower them, then that frees them up to become more creative. So by loosening the reins at the top, what you're doing is you are having a larger number of people solve problems. And the reason is because you don't know actually what the structure of the problem is. You know the organizational structure, but you don't know the structure of the problem. If you free them up and let them be loose, then they can conform to the problem and figure it out and help. And it becomes an organization that's more emboldening and freeing for people.
Yeah, that makes sense. How do you go about creating a culture whereby each group in a company are able to recognize the importance of balancing competing desires rather than succumbing to the pressures of group conformity?
Well, I mean, having seen different groups, I think the trick, and you can get there, is the explicit recognition that the different groups do have agendas that are not exactly aligned. So if you take any company, you may have a marketing organization and an engineering and sales and so forth. And at one level, you could say, well, they want to make something which is going to make some contribution to the world, whatever it is they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So there is alignment there. But in fact, the jobs given to the marketing people are not exactly the same as they are for the salespeople or the people creating something new. Their time horizons are different. Their local objectives and the near-term objectives are all different. And all of which is fine. The problem comes is if any group thinks that their agenda is actually the right one. And in a healthy organization, the groups recognize that we are actually in a balance between them. And if I try to win, and if I do win, then in fact we lose. And it's getting people to understand that there is a balance between those. Now, what is the balance point between all those different organizations? It's in the middle. And where is that well-defined point in the middle? Well, the well-defined point doesn't exist. So again, we're always in this dynamic balance between these. And while we don't know exactly where that point is, the one thing I can say is that if any one of those groups wins, we lose.
Yeah, okay. There was one story in the book that I felt in many ways highlighted your management style, Ed, that the decision not to reprimand the person who wiped the hard drive of virtually the whole of Toy Story 2. Was that an easy decision, or did that just fit quite comfortably into the philosophy that you'd built up?
Well, that particular one, to be honest, was fairly easy because it was clear that it was an accident.
Right.
So while the person was embarrassed and didn't fess up, like we never found out who made the accident, it was an accident.
Yeah.
So
a big one.
Yeah, and it was a big accident. But that's the nature of these, against the structure of the problems, right?
Yeah.
It's if you think about it, we didn't have in place the mechanisms to prevent that kind of accident from happening, nor did we have in place we thought we had in place, but it wasn't working. We didn't have a working system to back us up in case there was an accident. And as you know, you should always back things up. Our system failed and we didn't know it. So the real issue for us wasn't, did somebody make an accident? Because they happen all the time. It's, okay, what do we do to make the system more robust? If we turn the focus onto the person who made the accident, we actually have not solved any problems.
Yeah.
Now, it sometimes gets trickier if it's visible. If somebody makes an error and it is visible, then it is a conscious effort to say, you know, people just make mistakes. It's okay. And you have to get that message to them that it is okay. Okay, so now let me get to a tricky one though. Because I spent some time talking about the brain trust.
Yeah.
And the brain trust is a group that is candid with each other. And we've put in mechanisms to try to make sure they are candid with each other. And the truth is, usually that mechanism works pretty well. That's why the films are good.
Could I just interrupt a second there? The Brain Trust is the group of directors that come together, and not just directors, who basically, through a collaborative process, where candid and openness to making mistakes is in place. Is that roughly what it is?
Yeah, so we have a group of storytellers, so it can be writers, directors, and they come together occasionally for each film. So there's a full-time person on the film, the director, and the director's team of people who are working with him or her, and they're full-time trying to solve the problems. But they kind of get lost and they lose objectivity in the thing they're working on.
Right.
So every few months they will show it to their colleagues. And their colleagues will then give them feedback because they've been out of the loop and they can come in as fresh eyes, but also as people who have been through it before. So they know how to be helpful. So it's important that they be honest about what they see. And it's important that the director and his or her team are open to listening. So brain trust isn't just a group of smart people. It's a way of getting information to and listening to that information to help solve the problems. Now, having said that, there still is this human emotion and dynamics at work inside of everybody.
Of course, yeah.
So the stability of it, sometimes it gets pushed one way or the other. It's not a stable environment. You actually have to work on keeping that to be a good environment. And in general, it works very well. Occasionally it breaks down and we have to make some adjustments. And occasionally magic happens. It goes way beyond, and there's this amazing flow that happens within inside the room that's basically indescribable. But that's the notion of this brain trust. Okay, so imagine that somebody new comes into the room, and you've said to the person, it's okay to make mistakes or throw out ideas which might even be dumb. So it doesn't matter whether you're experienced or new, you've got to be able to say something which is off track to throw out a new idea, and somebody may consider it, then it doesn't work, and so you pass on to something else.
Okay.
Okay, so here's one extreme. If you say something dumb and then you are rejected, they say you don't belong in the room, then clearly we will have introduced an element of fear in the room.
Yep.
So zero errors or zero bad ideas is counterproductive and it is a bad goal. Now, the reason I say this is there are industries where zero errors is very meaningful, like the aircraft industry. And we get that.
Yeah, or surgeons.
And surgeons. So we get what it means as customers or as whether it's manufacturers or the people that do, we know what zero errors means. But in our case, in this room and in creative environments, zero errors is a negative. It's a bad place to be. It's a wrong goal. It actually messes things up. Okay, so that's zero is bad. So let's suppose that new person says 40 bad things in the room. Well, at some point, the group is saying, he's saying so many things, it's actually getting in the way of the room and it's distracting. He doesn't get it. This person doesn't belong in the room. So 40 is not good. Zero is not good. Where is the optimal point between zero and 40? It's somewhere in the middle and it's not well defined and I don't know where that is. Just that it's in the middle.
That's great. It appears obvious from the book that you feel managers need emotional training as well as intellectual and practical skills. Do you think there's a wider recognition of this in business in the US in general, or is it more in the creative industries?
Well, I mean, we clearly hear people talk about it. I do think that a lot of people haven't intellectually figured it out. There was this old TV series, Star Trek, and you'll recall from Star Trek that Kirk was the emotional one and Spock was the logical one. And it's part of a conceit which still exists to this day. Like there's the logical component and then there's the emotional component. Without a full understanding that neuroscientists know is that a person who's got damage to their emotional part of the brain and their logic works perfectly fine is unable to make decisions. That it actually is the balance of the emotional with the logical which has us function. Again, and so it's a balance between the two. And then it just happens to be true of the way we work, but since a lot of people don't understand that, they can go down the wrong direction, or they may think other things important, like they need to appear to be in charge, or they need to appear not to make mistakes. And what's happening is their emotional needs for their recognition or power, whatever it is, are actually getting in the way of their functioning as a human, working with other people and trying to allow them to rise to do their best.
Okay. How do you maintain a work-life balance and run two huge companies in tandem?
It's not easy. And I also have I still have a young child at home. So we have to have a balance there. I just had a grandchild born last week. So I'm happy about that. I do meditate every day.
Right.
Between a half hour, an hour a day. And I exercise about 4 or 5 hours a week. So the balance for me is that there is a part of my life which is focused inward. And in doing so, I've learned that focusing inward is not the same thing as focusing outward. It's not focusing outwards, facing inwards. It's actually a different kind of experience. And I also think that's true of groups of people, too. There are times when you need to focus inward, and it's a different kind of thing than focusing outward. And then the next step is to try to integrate the inward and the outward together in terms of your life. So that's my approach to do it. And again, it's an ongoing struggle.
And my last question, Ed, why is it you joined the Middle Way Society?
Well, the one thing I'm wrestling with as I try to understand this is how to think about what the middle means and how dynamic and rich it is. And reading the book and seeing a society to it, it's basically a group that's thinking about what it means to be in that place and trying to define it and understand it. In understanding it, I think that we are better as people.
Okay. Well, that's great, Ed. Thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.